Welcome to Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life. Each month, Galley Table Storytelling hosts a live event in the Kodiak community. Storytellers are given 7 minutes to tell a personal story related to a monthly theme. Tonight, we're going to hear those stories.
Good evening. This is Astrid Rose, co-founder of Galley Table Storytelling. Tonight, we have a very special, unprecedented event put together for all of you Galley Tables fans. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic this year, we sadly had to cancel the last two shows of Season 7. But fortunately, we had six wonderful volunteers send us recordings of their stories, and we were able to put this show together for you. Tonight, we'll have music by local musician Monica Sager with original songs, followed by four stories for the theme of Woulda, Coulda, Shoulda. At intermission, we'll showcase two more songs by Monica and end the show with two stories for the theme Lost in Translation. Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the show.
Thought we'd walk around today and live for tomorrow. Thought we'd do something grand, like touch the stars or swim the entire ocean. Thought we would relax, relive, restart our lives starting today. Thought we would give up, give in to everything that makes us brave. Let's occupy our thoughts, our time, our lives with everything, with everything brand new. 'Cause all I know is when I go home, I wanna stay with you. So don't you tell me there's no hope for tomorrow. And don't you swim in an ocean full of sorrow. 'Cause if you tell me there's no hope for tomorrow, well then you'll drown in an ocean full of sorrow. Touch the stars or swim the entire ocean.
Hi guys, this is Connor Whiteside, and I'm sharing my story for Galley Tables on Coulda, Woulda, Shoulda. So in my story, there's lots of things that I could have done differently, would have done differently, and most certainly should have done differently. I'm also really thankful that this Galley Tables is remote because there's no way I would share otherwise. So hope this makes you happy, LME. This story takes place back when I was in high school. And just like now, I was an avid sports fan. So I'd save up any money from mowing lawns or babysitting or whatever it would be. And a lot of times, friends and I would try to see if we could get into a game, into some nosebleed seats, whether it was football. That was usually above my pay grade on my own. But a lot of times we would get into basketball or baseball games with some buddies. So anyways, we ended up going to a Pacers game for any basketball fans out there. It's been about $7 a piece, me and my friend Dakota. And something that's very strange about Pacer games is they have phenomenal snow cones. It's just really random. You know, the basketball season, most of it's in the winter. So it's not necessarily something that comes to mind, but they have extremely good snow cones. So as soon as we walked in that stadium that night, Dakota and I were already talking about what flavors we were going to get, when we were going to get them. So we were brainstorming when would be a good time. And by halftime, we had made up a plan. In between the third and fourth quarter, we were going to hurry up so we wouldn't miss much game time and grab a snow cone. But at this point in time, we'd already had some nachos and they were not sitting very well in our stomachs. So we had to amend our plan and make a pit stop to the bathroom first. So we thought we were in good shape, right? Had a bulletproof plan on how we were getting our snow cones. So as we were going to the bathroom, we're just chatting it up in the stalls. It's pretty quiet in there, not a lot of people. Talking about who's playing well, how the first half went. And then it sounds like more and more people are coming in the bathroom. So we just stop. Dakota's sitting on my right, in the stall to my right. There's another person in the stall to my left. And so I thought it would be funny to just pull a little prank on Dakota here. So I thought I could just fooling around, play footsie with them, freak them out, agitate them, just cause a little problem. So I start doing that, and I lean down with my right foot and just start messing around. I play footsie with his foot for a few seconds. Stays really still, so I was pretty disappointed. I was like, well, that didn't go as planned. So I start pushing up his pant leg, just messing around, trying to freak him out or get some sort of reaction, but he wasn't giving me anything. So I did that for about 5 seconds, and then I was like, well, all right, well, this is just weird now. I feel like I was supposed to be funny, and now he's just being a party pooper, trying to do something or put it back in my face. I don't know what he's doing. So anyways, after about 5 to 10 seconds of that, right when I'm stopping, slowly his foot just pulls away and drags across the floor away from mine. And again, I'm like, that was weird, but didn't really say anything for a little while. And then about a minute passes and sounds like the bathroom has calmed back down. People have left, it's gotten more quiet. So I lean over to my right a little bit and say like, hey Dakota, you ready to get snow cones? I'll wait for you in the concourse. To which he says, yeah, sounds good, I'll be out shortly. However, his voice came from my left in the stall instead of my right. And at this point comes that feeling that every single person has felt at some point in life, sleeping in through an important class or interview, whatever it is, it's that helplessness that you can't fix. I knew I was screwed. I had only two options, fight or flight. And honestly, they both were mostly flight. I could either wipe and call it a day and just sprint home at this point, get as far away as possible, or I could just park it right there and stay the entire night until the janitors come around that night to let me out. I was so scared, did not know what to do. So I decided on going all the way back to my seat, not stopping for anything, and just praying that I wouldn't see anyone with those army green Vans. They were almost identical to Dakota's. So about 5 or 6 minutes pass by, and Dakota walks down our aisle looking confused and a little bit upset. And he says, what the heck, man? I thought you were waiting on me and we were going to grab snow cones. He did get a snow cone, thankfully. But I asked him, do you remember when I played footsie with you in the stall? He said, what? No. I told him that was why. So there were things I definitely would have done differently, could have, and definitely should have done differently. But at least it makes for a good story. Thanks for listening.
Shoulda, coulda, woulda, by Sheila Beardsley. I'm going to tell you about the day I lost Mark, my husband, in the skiff. But first I'm going to tell you why it's probable, based on some of our mishaps. Mishap 1. Probably should have something stronger than Advil and beer at fish camp. Especially if the cushion between your vertebrae ruptures. The pain is so excruciating that you can't get off the floor. This was Mark, the last one left at our fish camp. No one to help unless he dragged himself to the VHF to call for help. Could have, but he didn't. A day later, a friend stopped by and evaluated the situation. She called a doctor in Kodiak and figured out how to get Mark standing in the back of a pickup truck for a short ride through the village to the airstrip. Mark flew to town on his pain meds, Advil, and the beer he slammed to make the flight in the small plane a bit bearable. The Kodiak doctor wrote a prescription for him, said take these and get to a hospital. The MRI machine in Kodiak was broken, so Mark flew across the state to Ketchikan. It was the nearest hospital to our home at the time. I traveled by ferry from Prince of Wales to Ketchikan to meet Mark. Mishap 2. First day, setting gear for the season. Mark and crew pull lines down the beach and coil them into the skiff. Mark goes through the safety briefing about hands and fingers and placement on the anchors. And then Mark gets his thumb in the anchor and someone moves the fluke. His thumb is stuck. Not sure yet of the damage under his rubber glove. That is, until the blood runs out. He tries to take the glove off. Too gory. So he puts it back on. They decide better skip to Larsen Bay and go to the clinic. The doctors and radiology are called in Kodiak. Mark waits at the village clinic for an answer. The surgeon asks if it's a finger or a thumb. It's a thumb. The surgeon states, dang, you need a thumb. He says he will cancel his rabbit hunting trip and head into the hospital to meet Mark. Mark waits in Larsen Bay at the clinic with the only local professional to assist, the VPSO. While they wait for a plane, the VPSO shares his personal stories of digits deformed and losses of his other digits, then proceeds with, well, we better get the catheter going while we wait. The rest of that summer, which was the whole summer, Mark had a stitched-on thumb and two rods sticking out of it, bitten into two directions, like an antenna. No way he was picking fish. He ended up being our designated skiff driver, zipping around the bay with his hand elevated above his heart like this. You will just have to imagine it looking like a permanent hello. He looked like the friendliest fisherman greeting every oncoming boat. Mishap number 3. We were getting ready for a trip off the island, and Mark was scrambling to finish milling a tree in order to stack and dry the lumber in preparation to send out to fish camp on a tender. I'm on my way home. I pass Mark near the Baptist Mission. He seems extra friendly, waving to me. Maybe because he knows I have tunnel vision. So I assume he was just trying to make sure I noticed him. Because, as you probably noticed, there are lots of white trucks in Kodiak. I keep driving home. There, I check my phone. It reads, I'm at the ER. Long story short, Mark loses the top of his ring finger. We have had our share of fish camp mishaps over the past 25 years, including lost in the fog, running out of gas in a storm, shearing off our prop while skiffing across the bay, the cat that gave Mark a black eye, and the bears that ransacked our buildings and our water lines. Oh, and the time we decided to burn down our old warehouse that turned into burning the beach grass and part of our cabin. It seemed like a good idea at the time. It was a calm morning, until it wasn't. So with this background information, maybe you have gained a sense of why I would think Mark could go missing in our skiff. A day in our life at Setnet Camp includes, and almost always includes, kelp. I'm going to share a day soon after we had a skiff built. It is wide and stable. It's great. We no longer notice when someone sidles up next to you, from stern to bow, or from side to side, as was the case for me on this particular June day. A factor for extra kelp on this day was the wind. It was blowing a constant northeast 35 directly on our nets and beach, with extra gust on top for good measure, blocking our ears of any sound beyond the wind, even when standing right next to each other. We had so much kelp on our nets on this day that we could not go a boat length, 23 feet, before filling up with pounds of the green and slimy stuff. We had to stop, chop, and throw to the outgoing current. Mark and I were working our way through the bulk kelp leaves and tails, slashing the bulbs with a machete and Victorinox, when Mark went missing. Did he slip and fall out? I could not hear him over the wind. These weather days always heighten my awareness of all the things that can go wrong, in addition to my memory of all the things that have gone wrong. I was in the bow, bobbing up and down and sliding from gunwale wall to the net and back, when I looked behind me for Mark. He wasn't there. The motor was in gear, and Mark was nowhere to be seen in the skiff. I'm yelling. I ran down the starboard side, where there was less kelp. I looked over the side, still yelling. He was not in the water. I yelled for him with no luck over the wind, skating my way through the kelp to the back. I put the motor in neutral. Panic filled my body from legs to throat. I ran to the net side. Near the front, I worked my way up there. Mark was there, leaning over the side of the skiff, freeing kelp from our net. He looked at me with surprise that I was on his left side. I looked at him, still stricken with fear, but relieved. How did I not see him? While Mark was bent over the side of the skiff, his upper body in half, his red jacket not visible, it was folded over in the wind, hanging around his head, concealing the outer red side of the jacket, exposing his Helly Hansen bib overalls, the only thing left to be seen of him in the skiff, which happens to be the same color as the kelp. Lesson learned. If only we would have bought high-vis jackets and guy cotton pants.
Hello, Galley Tables community. My name is Becky Pollum. I'm 25 years old. I'm about to graduate with my bachelor's in elementary education, and I'm 6.5 months pregnant. What a time to be alive. I had initially signed up, I think like back in November, to do Galley Tables in April because I thought it was going to be like this celebratory time of like being done with school. It's almost summer, and then, you know, coronavirus. So here we are, and I just have a few stories I want to share about some shoulda, coulda, wouldas in my life. They all kind of stem from my first real job. And, you know, when you're 18, you have a lot of firsts in your life, you know, like first time going to college, first time living on your own, first time adulting. And one of my firsts at 18 was my first boyfriend. And so I'd never had a boyfriend before, and it was a solid three-month relationship, and then it was over. And even though I was the one that broke up with him, I was completely heartbroken for some reason still, and I had a lot of big emotions, and I didn't know how to deal with them. So one night, I was super late, and I was crying in my bed, and I decided the best way to take care of these emotions was to text my best friend Clara about everything I was feeling. And so I was sitting there, and I block text, you know, of like, oh, I'll never find anybody ever again. He was the only one. It took me 18 years to find somebody, and now what am I going to do? And anyways, a bunch of garbage emotions and not really thinking clearly. Clearly, I was not thinking, because about 20 minutes later, I was really offended that she hadn't texted me back. Usually she was very on top of making sure she met my emotional needs whenever I texted her. And so I opened my phone and I was about to click on the text message and text her back when I realized that I had not texted Clara, but rather I had texted Cliff, who is her father. And not only was he her father, he was also my brand new boss I had had for about a month. And so I felt my heart drop to my stomach and I realized I just texted my new boss all of my deepest, darkest fears and emotions that only Clara was supposed to see. And so I had no other ideas of how to deal with this other than to spam text him apologies because I was so embarrassed. And so sent him, please don't read anything. Yeah, I just sent you. I mean, maybe you already read it. I'm so sorry. Oh, I know it's late. We have work tomorrow. You know, I just hope you ignore everything, you know. And I'm just hoping the more texts I send at this point, it just buries the first giant one that I didn't want him to see. And, you know, I should have just not texted anything. That would have been a great choice. I could have just waited till the next day to, you know, talk to Claire in person. I would have saved myself a lot of embarrassment at work the next day as Cliff lovingly brought it up in front of all of my coworkers. So that was great. He really was a great boss. I really did appreciate him as a boss. And about 2 months later at the same job, I was a mover at Kodiak Transfer. RIP, you know. But I was in the kitchen because I would always start in the kitchen and pack out. And I was going through the customer's junk drawers, which every customer has at least one, if not more, junk drawers in their kitchen. And I'd usually just like kind of go through and kind of scoop it all out and put it in a box. And one of the rules that we had was that we had to make sure that none of the devices that we packed had batteries in them because they were supposed to like explode or something. I don't know. So we had to take them out just so we weren't liable if that did happen or something, but I don't even completely understand. So I open up this junk drawer. I start going through it like usual and I pull out this device looking thing about this big and I was trying to see if it had batteries and I couldn't see anything. It was really nondescript. I had no writing on it. All I could see was a button. So I decided to press it. And so I, you know, just holding it out in front of me, press this button. And all of a sudden, a second later, I feel this puff of spray go over my face. And I realize, unfortunately, I just pepper sprayed myself in the face. And I instantly start feeling like my whole face is on fire. And I just start snotting. Like, instantly, I lose all feeling in my mouth. I start crying. I can't really open my eyes. And I start screaming for help because what else do you do? I'm 18. I'm completely helpless and dumb. And just pepper sprayed myself on accident. And one of my coworkers comes in trying to help me, but then he gets choked out of the room because pepper spray's everywhere. It's all over. This red spray's all over their perfectly white kitchen. And the customer comes in and he's apologizing because he's like, oh, I should have taken it out. I knew it was in there. I didn't think about it, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like trying to tell him it's fine, but I'm crying and snotting all over the place. And finally make it out of the kitchen and I go and take a break outside and I'm sitting in this empty box truck crying, trying to eat a Clif Bar, not realizing that I probably just should have asked to go home because like take care of myself. But I don't know why I thought I had to tough it through, but I sat there for about 20, 30 minutes and I finally had some feeling back and I could keep my eyes open for longer than 10 seconds. So, I decided to stick it out for the rest of the day because it made sense to me for some reason at 18. And I should have just asked the customer what it was. He was in the room right next to me. I could have just quickly asked him what it was. I could have just, you know, put it in the box because it didn't have any batteries in it. But I would have saved myself some long-lasting pain because not more than 3 hours later, I had to go use the bathroom. So we're still at this customer's house. I go into their bathroom and I, you know, with that pepper spray, I just am snotting and sniffing all day because of just pain. And I needed to blow my nose. So I'm in there, I get some tissue paper, I go and blow my nose. And instinctively, after blowing my nose, I suck everything back in through my nose after I do it. So, you know, just suck it all back in, right up back into my sinuses. I had not thought about the fact that there had still been pepper spray residue in there. And as I'm screaming from the pain of it going back into my sinuses, I go and touch my face instinctively with my hands, because when things hurt, you like try and cover it with your hands. It's like part of, I don't know, our brain or something. But what I had failed to realize, that all the pepper oil was still all over my hands, because it doesn't just like wash off with soap and water. So now I'm sitting in this customer's bathroom, blinded, in pain, with my pants off on the toilet, completely helpless again. I'm just sitting there thinking, I should have just gone home. I should have just gone home. And when I got home that night, I just soaked my face in milk and was trying to figure out what to do with my life. But anyways, yeah, those are two of many stories from that job. I did not make a lot of great decisions at that job. But anyways, I hope they brightened your day in your quarantining and social distancing life that we have today. Anyways, have a good one, everybody.
Next up, we have Gretchen Powers. This year, she was a rock star volunteer with our team, taking beautiful pictures at all of our events. Here's Gretchen.
In the almost 3 years I've lived in Kodiak, there is almost always been a car parked at Dead Man's when I come around the corner. No matter whether it's raining sideways and upwards and downwards in every which direction, or if it's a gorgeous sunny day, there's always someone parked there. Anywhere else in the country, in the world even, I wouldn't think twice about it necessarily, but here, that view. When we first moved here, it took my breath away. And then there was a period of time where I became numb to it almost. And you always think when you see something so beautiful, I could never take this for granted. I could never become numb to this place. There's no way that the way that the mountains come out of the ocean and the waves crash against the shore and the birds swoop and the colors are so vibrant, there's no way that that could ever become something that I could just blink my eyes at and think, oh, well, it's just another day in Kodiak. But that happens. I think it happens to us anywhere we live. And it happened to me, I would say, about a year and a half into living here. And while it was probably one of the darkest times I've experienced in maybe my entire life, it was also a time where I learned a lot about myself. And I learned what it took to be resilient, and I learned what it took to be a badass, independent woman living in Alaska. And for that, I will always be grateful to this place. Because you can't hide from your bullshit here. You can't hide from your stuff here. You can't go hide under a rock and pretend it never happened. You can't hide and assume your mental health issues will just go vanish, or that whatever it is that you're grappling with will become insignificant. Places like this, remote, gorgeous, intolerable places in remote areas of Alaska, bring out that stuff. It rips the rug right on out from underneath of you, and it makes you see everything that's difficult, everything that's hard, everything that's challenging, and it makes you come to grips with it. And I have a lot of moments sometimes where I think about shoulda, woulda, coulda. How could I have done something better? Should I have said something different? Should I have done X, Y, and Z in a different way? Is there a way I could have been better through this process? But living here in Kodiak was the best thing for me and the best thing I could have ever done. And as hard as it has been, and as much as it's made me face the demons inside me and the deepest, darkest parts of myself and the parts that oftentimes I'm ashamed to show, at the same time, it's also shown me the most beautiful things. It's shown me the way that I am full of a deep amount of love that I didn't even know was possible, that the way that I love other people is very vibrant and full of joy. And it made me realize that life is often full of these joyful moments, even in times when we feel as isolated as we might right now. Because in the last 6 weeks or so that I've been living in relative isolation away from my friends, even in such an isolated place as we live, I've felt innumerable amounts of joy. And I wonder sometimes why that is. How is it possible to live in an isolated place, to be living mostly by yourself, to be avoiding contact with your dearest friends, and still to be able to be enriched with this amount of contentment and satisfaction? And I think it's because Kodiak has taught me how to truly be present and to how to take each day by day with what she gives you, whether it's sideways sleeting rain or overwhelming sunshine that makes you need 6 pairs of sunglasses on your face or your eyes will literally feel like they're going to pop out of your head as you're popping ibuprofen at 4 o'clock in the afternoon after a hike and you just have this headache that's like, hello, sun. But I'm truly grateful for so many things that I've learned here. And one of the things I think that's the strongest thing I've really come to recognize is that shoulda, woulda, coulda doesn't exist in Kodiak. There is really only what is now and what will be and what you can make of it. And make the freaking best of it. If there's one thing I've learned in being limited, it's that if you look at your options and your possibilities, even on the smallest contentment scale, it's that they really, truly are limitless. I mean, look around us. This is one of the most beautiful places I've ever had the privilege to live. And of all the places in the world that I'd love to be stuck in confinement with myself and my family, it would be Kodiak, Alaska. Because even on the darkest, dreariest, grayest, rainiest, sideways, sleetingest days, she is one of the most magnificent places I've ever seen. And I know I will miss her dearly when it's time for us to go.
Snow will cover this town till it all burns down, and we'll run our separate ways to the ends of the earth. The snow will cover this town till it all burns down, and we'll run our separate ways to the ends of the earth. You can change if you know it's bound to break you. It's not a path that you can't go down if you know it'll take you there. In the summer we will find there's nothing but gardens and dreams, both left unkept through the winter time. And so the snow will cover this town till it all burns down, and we'll run our separate ways to the ends of the earth. Snow will cover this town till it all burns down, and we'll run our separate ways to the ends of the earth, to the ends of the earth. I've been wandering in circles, and I've been wandering down streams, and I've been walking on ledges, and I've been talking up dreams, and I've been making up stories and talking loud in my sleep, but nothing makes it seem like it's a possibility for me. So I move far away from what's keeping me from who I'm meant to be, and I choose to be set free from the tired old
Lost in Translation, here's Michelle Weekly to start us out.
Last October, I got a call from a friend of mine, Jenny Birchfield, who was living in Colorado with her mom. Jenny and I had been in the Peace Corps together. We had lived in the same region, and we became very close, as we did with another volunteer named Chase. So Jenny was making a three-way phone call to Chase and I to tell us that her mom, Pat, after a 2.5-year struggle with ALS, which is Lou Gehrig's disease, her mom had passed away. And I knew Pat. She had visited us when we were in Guyana. And then I visited twice with her in the States. The second time was at her home, and that's when I witnessed how this disease had started to ravage her body. And she was one of the bravest women I had ever met. She had only two faces, smiling or laughing, and I was told that she did both almost to the very end. So Chase and I, we booked our tickets to go to Colorado for the celebration of her life, and Jenny said, we'll just camp out in the basement. So we arrived at the home, and the home was not a huge home. The top floor was like 1,100 square feet, and then the basement. But the basement was filled from floor to ceiling with a lifetime's worth of possessions, except for the places cleared out for the beds. So there were six people here. There was Chase, Jenny, and I, Tom, the husband. Pat had a twin sister, Kathy, and she had another daughter, Lisa. And we were all pretty big people, except for Tom. He was just a little guy. In this not very big house, and in addition to six people, there were five dogs. Kathy had brought her little gray terrier, which sat on her lap pretty much the whole time. And then the sister Lisa had a little white, morky, ankle-biting dog that I tried to stay away from at all costs. And then there were three resident dogs. There was Hazel, who was a brown, nondescript dog that Jenny had rescued from the streets of Guyana. And Hazel was so sweet and so grateful. And then there was Lola, a wonderful, happy, pleasant dog. And then there was Chewy. Chewy was an English bulldog beagle mix. But if you looked at him from the rear end, you would swear it was a pig. And Chewy had an eating disorder. And this eating disorder was that he couldn't stop eating any food that was anywhere in sight. And so if you were making a sandwich on the counter and you had forgotten the mayonnaise and you turned to the refrigerator, he could eat your sandwich in a flash. And this was a problem because people were bringing by lots of food, and what we couldn't fit in the refrigerator, we had to push way back on the counter, and still Chewy got a 12-pack of mini cupcakes. And on the morning of the celebration, Kathy had bought McDonald's breakfast for us, and Chase had a burrito, and he set it down for 1 second to help someone, and Chewy grabbed it and ate half of it before he could get to it. And believe me, if Chewy has eaten half of something, you don't want to eat the other half. They had put child locks on all their kitchen cabinets because Chewy was so good at breaking into them. Jenny said he ate a bag of flour as it turned to dough in his mouth. He ate a can of Crisco. And I saw the video, so I am not making this up. He could open a jar of peanut butter. He had the cap between his teeth, and then he was turning the jar with his paw. They had a special garbage can made out of wood that was bolted to the wall and had a lock on the top. And one night, I'm sound asleep in the basement, and I hear, Chewy, no! And I jumped up like, whoa, what's going on? And Chase was chasing Chewy around, yelling, he's got the Pringles! So I got to tell you, I was a little horrified because I'm not used to perpetually defending my food. And because there were so many flowers arriving, the whole kitchen table was filled with flowers. So we ate most of our dinners on our laps in the living room, and this was right at eye level with Chewy. So every dinner time was an adventure. And it wasn't like they didn't feed the dogs. Tom fed the dogs at 8 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, and 8 at night. And somehow Chewy would know that it was almost feeding time, and he could be sound asleep on the living room floor at 2:30, and then all of a sudden he'd let out this weird howl bark, something like, and Tom would say, Chewy, not yet, it's not time yet. And about 10 minutes later, he'd let out another howl, and Jenny would say, Chewy, shut up, it's not dinner time yet. And then at 3 o'clock, Tom would rise, and Chewy would simultaneously rise, and he would get fed. Then they had to feed him in a little pen in the kitchen because once he ate his dinner, he'd run around and eat all the other dog's food. So The last day I was there, everybody was gathered around, and I said to the family, I don't know how you put up with this. This dog is 13 years old. He's an eating machine. It's like a war zone in here when it comes to food. Why do you put up with this? And they all looked at me and nodded their heads, and Jenny said, well, about 6 months before Mom died, she was in a wheelchair. She had lost all ability to walk. She had lost the ability to speak. She was on a feeding tube. Her one arm was useless, but she could still use the other hand. And so they had mounted her phone onto her wheelchair where she could type out a message and then Alexa would read it out. So one afternoon, she typed out a rather long message and I wrote it down because I didn't want to miss any of it. And this is what she said. Everybody has to learn to talk nicer to Chewy, which I found amusing that the adults had to learn. She goes on to say, he is who he is. He'll always want food. He'll always want to go in a room. He's not invited. He'll always lay in my way. He'll always push the door open when possible. He'll always let you know if it's time for food or to go potty. So everybody, get a grip. He doesn't deserve to be nasty to 24/7. And I thought the only thing lost in that translation was the actual sound of Pat's voice.
Hello, I'm Gil Bain. I'm here today to talk to you for a while about lost in translation. It started when I was a student at the University of Washington, and then I got a call from the Tuna Commission asking me if I'd like to work with them in the tropical Pacific Ocean. I left and went to San Diego, started fishing on tuna boats, tagging tunas, and gathering information on the life history of tunas, the age and the growth and the populations. After a while, the Tuna Commission asked me to establish a laboratory in South America. So I went to Peru and opened a laboratory in Moncra and hired people. We did the same type of thing there, but in a more localized position. After several years, I decided I should go back to graduate school and study for a master's or doctor's degree. I applied to Cornell, was accepted, and went to Ithaca, New York, to Cornell University. When I got there, I took courses, but I did not know which direction I was going. But then one day, Starkist Foods Company asked me if I would like to join them on a cruise to explore the waters of Western Africa. I was delighted, and I thought maybe this would be an opportunity to gather information for a master's or doctor's dissertation. I, in the meantime, wrote a grant proposal to the Smithsonian asking for funds to collect fishes in different areas of Africa. I was granted that, so I bought nets, preservative bottles, and paid for the shipping. Then I put everything aboard and climbed on to the Columbia, a 120-foot-long tuna clipper, which left San Diego with a crew of five. We went across the Atlantic and ended up in Accra, Ghana. That was our home port. The actual port was in Tema. And so for several months after that, we worked out of Tema looking for tunas and tuna bait fishes. Now, Ghana is a small country about the size of the state of Oregon. There are 80 different tribes or groups there. They all spoke different languages. The common language was English because Ghana had been an English colony until 2 years before we got there. The common languages there were Fanti, Ewe, Twi, Chi, Ashanti, and Ga. There were several people in the fisheries department that wanted to come out with us. So we took between 5 and 10 fisheries people and taught them how to catch tunas and tuna bait fishes. Once we had the crew assembled and the men knew how to make the gear, we went out searching for schools of bait fishes. We went westward towards the Ivory Coast, and we found lots and lots of schools of fishes. We circled the bait fishes with a lampara net, pulled it in, and then we had the mothership come alongside, and we brailed the fish into live wells that could keep the fish alive for many months. Well, while we were catching bait, we looked on the beach, and there were elephants. Some of them were heading towards the Ivory Coast, and others were coming from the direction of the Ivory Coast. Some of them were gray elephants. The ones going towards the Ivory Coast were pink elephants. Now, not being able to speak the elephant language, like Dr. Doolittle, we couldn't ask them how they came to be pink elephants. But we did notice that they were heading towards cliffs at the other end of the beach. So we followed the gray elephants down there and saw them rolling in piles of red sandstone that had fallen from the cliffs. And these gray elephants then became pink elephants. Well, after we were satisfied with that, we went out to the continental shelf and started looking for schools of tunas. We found a lot of tuna schools. Mostly, they were mixed schools of tunas and skipjack, but some of them were pure tunas of 20 to 50 pounds in size. A lot of them were smaller, 1 or 2 or 3 pounds. Well, every day we would catch our fish, and the captain would call into the port and telling his contact how many tons of fish we had. Well, they somehow lost the information in translation and just recorded numbers of fish. So when we got 20 fish or 20 tons of fish, we went ashore to unload them, and the people on the docks were amazed because they'd sent down 4 women with tubs on their head, dressed in bright kente cloth costumes, and they were here to pick up the 20 fish. Well, they were amazed, and so was everybody else in the area, that we had 20 tons of fish. Well, these 20 tons of fish were parlayed over the years into the number one fishing port in West Africa for tunas. It's the number one fishing port in all of Africa. And in the world, it ranks number 4 for the landings of tunas. Well, after we unloaded the fish, I wanted to go out and collect all fishes from rivers and streams and ponds. And I was able to make the largest collection of freshwater fishes from Africa that was brought to the United States up to that time. Well, we did a lot of good collecting, and we went to this one large pond where I wanted to catch some upside-down swimming catfishes. Now, the catfishes swim upside down because they can feed on logs, and under the logs are crustacea and worms that they like to eat. So we thought we could get some there. On the bank, watching us collect fish, were a number of local people who spoke a dialect that none of our African boys could understand. They tried, but nothing seemed to come of it. Then the people on the bank started getting louder and louder. And about that point, out of one of the trees overhanging the waters where we were working, came a 4-foot-long green mamba snake. The snake fell onto my shoulder, slithered down my arm, and went into the water. I made a grab for it, but it got away. And then the people on the bank got louder and louder. So we thought that's probably what they were trying to tell us, that there were snakes here. All right, we wanted to hit one more log, and there was a log about 200, 300 yards away, and we started for that log when it swam away as a 10-foot-long crocodile. And that's what was lost in translation. Thank you.
Thank you again so much for tuning into our show tonight. We're looking forward to seeing you in the fall for the start of season 8. Stay safe and have a great story-filled summer.
Mm-hmm. Galley Table Storytelling is made possible through a partnership with the Kodiak Arts Council and Kodiak Public Broadcasting Corporation. Visit us online at galleytables.com to find the date and location of the next live storytelling event. You can also browse our archives and listen to past stories or sign up to be a storyteller. Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life.